Welcome to this talk from the Canando Zen Meditation Center. Located in Mountain View, California, Canando's meditation practice is open to the public. For more information or to get in touch with us, you can visit our website at canando.org. That's K-A-N-N-O-N-D-O.org.
Good evening. So a little while ago, somebody asked, what should we do with a mentally ill person? This was not a question about therapy. It was not a question about how to treat an illness or how to cure an illness. It was not a medical question. It was a religious question, spiritual question. It was a question that went beyond the matters of treating an illness. And the question was really about how should our practice respond to a mental illness? Or another way of putting it, maybe a more accurate way of putting it would be, how should we respond to someone who is out of harmony or out of balance, whose behavior shakes up our routine and creates disharmony, a disharmony within the family or community or in school, or in the workplace, or in the Sangha? How we respond to someone who is in such a state? We have to respond. We have to respond as a parent to a baby. You know, a baby is always creating disharmony. Or what the grown-ups would say is disharmony. To the baby, it's not. It's just doing something. But to the grown-ups, the baby is always creating disharmony because the baby continually has some needs, you know, and demands. And the baby is unable to express itself. The baby is unable to take care of itself. So naturally, it makes demands. The only way it can make its demands, the only way it can express demands is through creating disharmony. But even though a baby does create disharmony and difficulty and trouble and makes things out of balance, the mother does not isolate her child. Most mothers do not punish the child for disrupting a routine when it's simply trying to express itself. Isolating a child like in that way would be unnatural and create suffering where not necessary. So, just like the mother who intuitively knows what's going on with the baby and that its disruptive behavior is not intended to be disruptive, it's just the only way the baby knows how to express itself. In the same way, when we meet someone in our everyday life who is out of balance or whose behavior shakes up our routine, our attitude, our response to them has to be with selflessness and with caring. Same way a mother feels about her baby. We have to care for the person who is feeling isolated. That's the responsibility we have to each other. So the orientation of our spiritual practice is outward, or to the other, to others. If our attitude is instead towards ourself, we will create separation and isolation. That's known as an empty practice. If we feel that we definitely have to say no to someone who is out of balance, that can create disharmony. Especially if we feel, oh, he's too much trouble. It's too much trouble. I don't want to be bothered. When we notice we have impatience arising from that kind of attitude, it's important to explore that attitude. There is, in our spiritual life, in the spiritual life, there is a fundamental principle at work. Fundamental principle. And we come across it in when we read Dogen. His chapter titled "The Sound of the Valley and the Color of the Mountain." The layman Sotoba is hiking in the mountains, going from one town to another, and he stops. And he feels something. And when he gets home, he writes a little poem about the sound of the valley stream is his great tongue. The colors of the mountains are his pure body. There's a deep insight there into the nature of things. So in this short poem, nature itself is seen to have human qualities, tongue and body. So this poem expresses the insight that nature is expressing the truth, and nature affirms our life. And we know this is true because it's why we love nature. It's why we want to return to nature. It's why we enjoy going for hikes and for camping, and we want to get back to nature because we know this fundamental truth. At the same time, we ourselves are affirming nature. It's mutual. All life affirms all life. Your life affirms the life of others. The lives of all sentient beings affirms your life. This is the basis of a spiritual life, this truth. So the teachings of Buddha and the Eightfold Path that he taught, these are the fundamental principles of affirmation. that guide our life. And they reveal, or they hint to us, how to be in this world. How to be in harmony with reality itself. Every one of us here tonight, and everyone who we meet every day, no matter where we go, every one of us is out of balance sometime. We are out of harmony temporarily. We are all temporarily mentally ill. But most of us have the resilience to return to balance and to continue a life in relative harmony with others. But, you know, there are some people who are not so fortunate to have such resilience. For some people, harmony is very elusive and out of reach. And such people feel isolated, separated. So our job, our work, our practice is to affirm life as we meet it. And when we encounter isolation in ourselves or in someone, to try to create harmony and end the isolation. So we try to be encouraging. And when we don't know what to do in those uncomfortable and difficult situations where someone is out of harmony, or we feel out of balance, we have to try something. We have to experiment. And when we ourselves feel out of harmony, in other words, when we feel mentally ill, we quiet our mind and we return to balance. So, I'm sure most of you have read Dogen in his perhaps most famous passage where he said, to study the self is to perceive oneself as all things. Or in other words, all things are affirming all things continually. And this affirmation is not passive. It is continuously active. It is continually practicing this affirmation. Just like the mountains and the rivers that are continuously aware of what is going on. They are continuously engaged. Several years ago, I had the opportunity to go to Indonesia for a conference. And when I was there, I met a Chinese Zen master, Chinese Zen teacher from Singapore. And he wrote a book about the essentials of Chan practice. And in his book he wrote, sitting itself will not give you enlightenment. Meditation will not give it to you. It will only lead you to the brink. Retreating from the world will not liberate you. Happiness is not found in a secluded forest or an isolated cave. Enlightenment comes when you connect to the world. Only when you truly connect with everyone and everything. And he further wrote, "You can feel your enlightenment only by going deeply and fully into the world. That's how you obtain liberation." So when we meet each other or pass each other or take leave of each other, we bow to each other in an act of affirmation. And when we bow to each other, we should not be indifferent and we should not be passive. We should fully connect with each other in this simple gesture. And when we do, it is a moment of giving up ourselves and expressing the joy of being with the other person, without any concern about whether this is our favorite person or not our favorite person. We just affirm the joy of being with someone. So Suzuki Roshi said, sometimes we bow to cats and dogs. It means we make no distinctions who we bow to. We bow fully, completely to whoever we meet. We bow to cats and dogs. We have to be ready to bow to anyone. There is great power when we sit with each other, like we did tonight, or like we will do in the morning, like we did this morning. Everyone experiences the power of sitting with others because it is an act of affirmation. When we sit together, we affirm each other. When we sit together quietly, without trying to verbally communicate or touch, just sitting quietly, we are expressing our acceptance of each other without judgment. When we sit in this way with each other, without the need for words or demonstration of any kind, just quietly sit and accept each other and affirm each other, we have a chance to shake off a sense of isolation that is becoming more and more a problem in the modern world, created by all the advances in progress and technology. Technology has great benefits for us. It's given us wonderful things. But in our excitement for it, we don't recognize how it can isolate us. So we come together in practice to affirm each other, to affirm ourselves, and put an end to the isolation. Sometimes when my wife and I go to San Francisco, we will take BART, so we don't have to drive. And I enjoy that, just to looking around and being interested in watching people. And I especially liked to do that when I was in Singapore, on the Singapore subway. watching people. And you know what? They do the same thing that people in BART do. They keep their eyes down on their phone. Here and there. I'm more interested in looking at everybody and studying faces, and everybody else is looking down, isolating from each other, missing the chance to connect. Even if it's just with a glance, missing the chance to connect. Isolating themselves from each other. So there's a paradox, big irony, that we all aspire for harmony and for community. And we know how precious this Sangha is. But even in our aspiration for harmony, we arm ourselves so that we can be isolated without realizing what we're doing. It's an interesting phenomenon. So we do have to reflect on how to use the technology that's been given to us. We have to ask when and where and what is the purpose and what is the value, and considering all the people around us, considering how to use technology helps us reflect on how to use our life, when to do things, where to do things, what is the purpose of doing something, what's its value, how does it impact other people. So we have to ask ourselves, do we want harmony or do we want isolation? Do we want to be active in the continual affirmation of all things? So when a difficult person appears, when we meet with a person who is out of balance, our practice demands that we be spiritually creative. That is, to find a way to affirm in that situation, to find a way to say yes. When we affirm, when we express our affirmation with the people and things that we meet, this is the starting point of creating a caring mind and an attitude of taking care. This is a world that needs taking care, taking care of. Just like a little baby needs taking care of. We can take care of that baby when we care. And we can take care of each other and affirm each other when we care. And this is how Buddhism started, because there was a man who looked at the world and looked at the suffering and he cared. Does anyone have a question? Yes, Columbine.
I haven't really formulated a question, but I guess your talk was very personal to me just because my mother has always been kind of unstable, and there have been periods where we don't communicate because of me. She's kind of moved to, like, the middle of nowhere, so she's kind of isolated herself, and I think that's the way that she's remarried, so she has that support. And recently, things have kind of gone down, and I think my dad has kind of said, you know, take a step back, and because he sees me just being like, this is like hitting my head against the wall, trying to work with it and just not getting anywhere. But part of me feels compelled to tell her that I love her. But at the same time, it's sort of like, if it is truly a baby, sometimes you have to set boundaries, right? And let the baby cry for a while. So I guess the not really a direct question, but do you engage or do you not engage? Like, is it okay to take a step back?
You know, sometimes it's necessary. And knowing that we have this choice to engage or not engage, it means we have to pay attention so that we know how to choose in each situation. And sometimes, most of the time, the choice isn't obvious. So we have to pay attention and rely on all of our awareness and our experience and our caring to know what we should do, what we think would be best. So sometimes we engage and sometimes we take a step back. It just depends. And we hope we get it right. But whatever happens, we learn from it and we use that experience the next moment. That's our life.
Thanks for your talk. I really thought it was very interesting. So caring at times, I feel, takes up a lot of energy. And I'm wondering, how can you stop from feeling exhausted all the time from caring too much?
We can never be so exhausted that we cannot care. Sometimes we need a rest. But we shouldn't stop caring, even when we have to take a rest. Sometimes we have moments where we say, oh, I don't care. Hopefully those are brief moments. Hopefully those are short-lived moments. For our own benefit, our own salvation, we should try to keep a caring mind. It's the caring mind that keeps us engaged. And it is in our nature to be engaged. It's not in our nature to be isolated. So if we feel exhausted, we just take a break, but we have to come back to caring mind.
I want to continue that question is, what if the people you want to care is actually keeping hurting you? Of course, you're saying it's never exhausted, that you want to care, and then you want to care, but you feel like there's a wall. And then not only the wall, exactly two walls. One is that person built for himself, the other wall is you built for yourself. Because you're so afraid, and then you're so afraid. And the reason is not, you know, you're saying is exhausted. Actually, my mother is like that, and because of that, my mother continued to keep caring, and she died. And then when I was 8. So, yeah, you want to give, but depends on the other side, which is I must have, you know, to step aside to see clearly that whether I do have the capacity to be able to. And then in the end, I'm actually surrendered. I thought, I'm a human being. I don't want to stop caring, but I think I have a limit. And then I made a decision, I drew the line, and then I still want to care, but I care in different format. Is that okay? Which is with a certain distance, and I pray, I care, but I just can't be in certain situation, which is that field, that power is actually overpowering me, and then, you know, it's attacking me.
Caring can occur naturally. Caring has to occur naturally. We can't make ourselves care. Well, if we come into a difficult situation or a confusing situation with another person, and it's uncomfortable, and we feel, I don't care. I don't want to care. If we can remember or become aware that the difficulty in any relationship occurs because there is suffering going on somehow. Somebody is suffering, which is creating a disharmony. So we do what we can. We try to find a way to respond to the difficulty, to the suffering. You know, if we meet someone and we find ourselves being uncomfortable, we have two choices. One is we can isolate from it and try to find some comfort by isolating ourselves, get away from the discomfort. Or we can say, I want to understand what's going on here. I want to understand where this suffering is coming from. And I don't want to run away. And we can do that. We can learn to do that by learning to be patient with each other, by learning to be patient with ourselves. So our practice tries to teach us to go slow down, so that we can be aware, so we don't feel we have to push past things, that going slow is okay. And when we have learned to go slow, we're not troubled by difficulty or disruption. We just let it be and be patient with it. If we can learn to care in difficult situations with difficult people, what great freedom.
If you're in conflict with somebody, in this situation, be like an office environment, and you're trying to deal with somebody that's motivated primarily by self-interest, kind of in effect, caring for them may seem as sort of a concession or kind of supporting that egomania in a way. And so things sort of reach a natural equilibrium by building a wall in between the two. I've personally struggled in how to bridge around that, staying away from sensitive subjects, but trying to build around it on the side so that you can find the common ground. I think there's a certain amount of skill in being able to find that. I don't know. I guess I'm just wondering if there's any advice to conflict as it relates to self-interest. So it's not necessarily mental illness, but supporting somebody else who, in effect, is going to push you down, make you feel worse, seems to just throw things out of balance. Like you're almost creating a situation for yourself that's worse and creates pain for you. And so your equilibrium, at least right now, it's at status quo, which is okay. But how do you?
So when you can recognize who you are in a very large sense, not just this, but if you recognize who you are, then you know nothing can hurt you. The other person can't harm you, whatever they say, whatever words they use or looks they give you. Or if you know who you are, you're no longer vulnerable to that sort of thing. And you can respond without fear or trying to be protective, just, okay. So, one of the things that happens with our practice, if you stay with it, is you begin to appreciate more and more. We begin to appreciate, understand more and more who we are in a large sense, so that the world doesn't seem threatening. Other people don't seem threatening. We know who we are. Nothing can touch us. Say what you want. It's okay. If we can feel that way, then we have a chance to be creative. Then we don't feel the need to be protective.
I'd like to thank you for all these questions because yeah, my question is actually around the same. It's around the people who I love very much, and I feel I can't help them, actually. And I'd like to ask about this spiritual creativity, because yeah, I spend a lot of time trying to find a way how to help somebody who doesn't want to be helped. Somebody who wants the world to change, who doesn't want to recognize that the problem of his suffering and suffering which is caused around by him is actually inside of him somehow. And unfortunately, the only way I found is some kind of isolation.
Some
kind of isolation actually. Yeah, because whenever I make myself available for this person, make this available for this person, yeah, this person tries to force me to do things this person wants me to do. And yeah, the only thing I can do is just protect myself, isolating. And I spent really many years trying to be creative, trying to build my some kind of immunity, some strength. But I got the point when I have to just acknowledge that I can't do anything. I believe this person will not change. And is there any space for creativity here? Is isolation a solution? I have more of these doubts and questions.
Isolation?
Is isolation a solution?
No. No, never. Never. I think one of the things we have to do is to not see these relationships as a game that we're trying to win. We just express our caring attitude wherever we go and not be concerned if somebody doesn't respond, if they stay isolated or angry or confused. We're not trying to win. We're just making our best effort. Can't win. We just make our best effort with a caring attitude. And if the other person doesn't seem to change, we can't worry about it. We made our best effort. And so there's some suffering, there's some difficulty that is beyond us. But the important thing for us is to be able to say to ourselves with some confidence, I made my best effort. With the best wisdom that I had. And that's all I can do. We have to be careful, especially in this day and age, to not try to keep a scorecard. It's hard to avoid getting caught up in it. It's so powerful, this environment we're in. But we keep trying.
This talk was brought to you by the Canandoe Zen Meditation Center in Mountain View, California. For more information or to support this podcast, go to canando.org. That's K-A-N-N-O-N-D-O.org.